Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Christine Hallquist officially launched her bid for governor in April, but it was back in February when she announced she was stepping down from her role as CEO of Vermont Electric Cooperative. The political neophyte says her experience running a utility shows she can manage a business, lead people, and keep the state's financial house in order. But she's facing down a longtime Vermont politician in his first term as governor. It's incumbent Phil Scott. Scott says his leadership style should win him re-election.
I try and lead by an example. I've always treated people with respect and civility. I listen, trying to do whatever I can, trying to find common goals. It's the only way, as a Republican. Again, I've been in the minority my entire political life, but I've accomplished a lot. You don't get there by seeking division. I believe there's more that unites us than divides us.
That was Phil Scott earlier this month on Vermont Edition. And today on the show, we get Christine Hallquist's take on the job and why she wants your vote. It's nice to have you back.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So what about what the governor says? How do you differentiate your leadership style from his?
Well, you know, I voted for Phil Scott. I heard the same thing in 2016 that he just said. But I'm highly disappointed because what I've witnessed was a divisive leadership using a command and control style, not a collaborative style. You know, when I look at he talks about affordability, but he vetoed a minimum wage increase. He vetoed a family leave bill, a toxic and toys bill, a polluters pay bill. So I think he's talking about affordability for the wealthy. And I will also say, you know, when we had the debate last week.
This was a debate in Rutland.
In Rutland, yeah. You know, he talked about when it comes to climate change, oh, we can't do anything. We'll wait for the federal government. When he talked about Medicare for all, oh, we can't do anything. We'll wait for the federal government. When he talked about raising the minimum wage, oh, we can't do that because New Hampshire is $7.50 an hour. You know, so it's clear, you know, that he's a nice guy. He's kind of feel good, but you know, I think in these times we need action.
You didn't give him much time. If you supported him when he ran for election in 2016 and you stepped down as CEO, you announced your resignation in February. So you were clearly thinking about running for governor at least a couple months in advance of that. That's not a lot of time for a first-term governor to actually get some traction.
Well, he showed his true colors with this legislative session when he vetoed the largest number of bills ever. What I see was a classic Republican following the national GOP, which is...
Do you mean this year vetoing but you were already running.
Well, I actually made the decision. Let me just say, I saw some evidence in the previous year. And when I saw, you know, I saw that he was following the tactics the same as the year before. He kind of sealed the deal this year. But the reason I'm running, I really made the decision January 20th when I listened to these Muslim girls making change talking about the bias that they experienced in the state. You know, in 2017, I was a bit in denial because I thought these Washington headwinds wouldn't affect us. But it was clear when we saw an increase in white supremacist activity for the first time since the early 80s. And I realized that, yeah, Phil, that really was what made the decision is we need more than just a feel-good governor right now. We need a governor who's going to protect us from what's happening out of Washington. That's what motivated me to run. But then when I started looking at what Phil was doing, I realized he really is a classic Republican.
I want to talk about some of those specific issues. But, you know, considering that what motivated you to run was looking at bias, looking at hatred, looking at racism and people not being treated fairly – you know, we've seen that in recent months. We've seen it integrated into politics. Kaya Morris stepped down as Bennington representative, saying she'd received death threats and racism directed at her. We've just seen a Republican candidate saying she's gotten death threats. We've seen a lot of this throughout the campaign, and I know you've received it as well. So what would you do as governor to try to defend against that?
Well, that's actually, again— what I see, you know, these are long-term problems, you know, that can't be solved with short-term feel-good problem issues or solutions. So specifically, when we talk about we've seen the underbelly of racism expose itself in Vermont. And I think, you know, I look at the governor's appointments, there are people like him. I would certainly, I'm committed to have people of color on my transition team, people of color on my boards, people of color on my administration.
Do you have people of color on your campaign team?
I do not have people of color on my campaign team.
Why not?
Well, because I basically decided in February 20th that I would jump into the campaign. I didn't have a lot of time to build a team. So we got a good team. We threw it together quickly. But certainly if I had more time, I would have pursued that. But I also say we need to do ethnic studies in schools. The governor claimed that, you know, this commission on that oversees the data on racism should report directly to him. I disagree. It should report to an independent third party, because I know from personal experience that we aren't even aware of our own implicit bias.
Which are you talking about, police reporting?
Yeah, I'm talking about I think we should be measuring schools, policing, and employment and how discipline is applied. And we should have an independent from the governor third party commission to review the data and oversee the corrective action.
What would you say your topmost priority is? You step into office in January and you have an inaugural address that lays out your agenda, or you decide what you want to put in that. What's the first thing that you want to tackle?
Well, the first thing I want to tackle is I want those bills brought to me that our governor vetoed. You know, I do want to
put a paid family leave.
Raise the minimum wage. You know, get that toxic and toys bill, polluters pay bill back. And then I would I participated for 2.5 years on a plan to get to 90% by 2050. It's called a Solar Pathways Plan. I would make that the comprehensive energy plan.
Renewables, 90% renewable
90%
energy.
90% renewable, yeah. And I would also immediately start work on the plan to connect every home and business with fiber optic cable, as well as work with the towns on rebuilding their towns. You know, I was in Bradford this weekend for the commissioning of their working space. They created which you see in the larger cities, you see these shared working spaces, which that's things we can do right in our own communities. I'm very proud of Bradford for their shared working space they just completed.
You talk about broadband coverage and how important high-speed internet and presumably reliable cell service is in all parts of Vermont. And, you know, this has been a thorn in the paw of every governor practically since the internet was created, but certainly for the last decade or more. I mean, just listen to this. Here's Governor Shumlin on his very first day in office in 2011.
Today, I am proud to launch Connect Vermont, an initiative to deliver by 2013 my promise of high-speed internet access and cell service to every corner of our state. If not, thank you.
All right. That was 2011. That certainly, that deadline of 2013 has passed us by, long passed us by. What makes you think you're going to be able to do this thing that every governor has said they want to do and none has been able to deliver on in terms of very last mile broadband?
Well, first of all, I am a utility manager, so I know how to do this. Secondly, I served 10 years on the Strategies and Technical Advisory Committee for the National Rural Electrocooperative Association, which that association is responsible for the electric delivery to all of rural America, which is 56% of the landmass. We've been watching and looking at this situation, and the situation we're experiencing in Vermont is a microcosm of what's going on in rural America. We're seeing an aging demographic, flights to the city, and increasing poverty. We saw the same thing in the 1930s when the cities had electricity and rural America did not. So our group focused heavily on this, and we developed a model. And the model is if the electric utility hangs the fiber in the electric space with their poles and their equipment, it cuts the cost by more than one half. And the electric utility can borrow and pay back over a 30-year period versus the telecom of a 15-year period. When you do it that way, you cut the cost by over 75%. Once you cut it that low, you can put it ubiquitously throughout Vermont. We've carried that model out in parts of rural America, and actually there's 60 electric cooperatives carrying that model out right now, one right across the lake here, Otsego Electric Cooperative. But I like to point out Tom Lazon's brother from Barrie, Jim Lazon, runs a cooperative in Iowa that's doing this with one-third the density of Vermont. So this is the model that exists. It works well. I would carry it out through the entire state. And I think it's very critical for economic development.
So does that mean then that the electric utilities are also in the business of being a telecom, or is it some kind of partnership? I mean, how does that specifically work? You're using the infrastructure of how we already get electricity to our houses, but who's actually doing the internet service.
Oh, well, so again, it's the exact same model of electricity. We've got a regular utility that brings the wire to your home, but we don't tell you what appliances to put in your home. Fiber would be the same thing. The fiber responsibility ends at the home. Then it's open access for any provider. It actually creates more competition for the consumer in the end with a higher quality, higher reliability, and a much faster connection.
You know, I'll just use my own. I live in a rural community. We have internet service. It's not particularly strong or very good. And not me yet, but some of my neighbors are able to get a higher, faster speed internet for a much bigger price. But we're already paying more than what people in Burlington pay. So how would you make it so that this happens but does not then become an insurmountable cost for people who live in rural communities?
Well, the model I just proposed actually creates an infrastructure cost lower than the cities.
So because there's competition and because the infrastructure is there?
Because the infrastructure is done at a much lower cost. And I should point out, you know, I'm on the highest level of connection for copper in my home. It's called bonded pair DSL, and there's no way you can run a business on it. Every time it rains, I got to reboot the modem several times. You get two or three people on it. You know, and that's really gets down to I actually personally worked this at the national level in Washington trying to get the definition of broadband changed. You know, the early governors were talking about broadband. Broadband is defined at 10 megabits per second. That's wholly inadequate for today's world. The average city is at 70 megabits per second right now, and it's going to grow to 200 megabits per second by 2021.
Is there a philosophical disconnect here, though, because we know that many Vermonters live rurally, and certainly our rural character is one of the things that we most value in this state. However, we also talk about renewable energy. We talk about global climate change. We talk about a need to have a transportation infrastructure that relies less on driving fossil fueled cars. And so if we are continuing to build out in our rural communities, we're not doing what the rest of the world is doing, which is moving more to urban communities, which allows you to have better transportation infrastructure in a more dense environment, allows better connectivity of nature. So how do you curb climate change? How do you get to our renewable goals, which includes certainly our fleet of cars on the roads, and yet also invest heavily in very rural communities?
Oh, you've packed a lot in that question. So let me just start by the top level. And first of all, I recognize the suffering that's happening in a rural community today. When I was the CEO of Vermont Electric Co-op, we served 18 of the 25 poorest communities in Vermont. And I think, again, you know, I look at microcosm of our politics. We've marginalized. I talk about marginalized community. I talk about physical communities that we've left out of the economic growth. So I certainly want to bring those, give those communities an opportunity to grow out of poverty. Secondly, you know, the type we're not talking about, I think this fits very well with Vermont's goals. You know, when we think about we're not going to go out and attract energy intensive businesses because that's not good. That's the climate change issue. We're not going to use our precious tax dollars to compete. We're going to grow our existing vacant spaces and fill those. You know, if you go my community, Morrisville, you know, half of our storefronts are empty, just like many storefronts all across the rural Vermont. So we're not going to actually build new infrastructure. We're going to use the existing buildings, and we're going to attract those kind of businesses that you know, small entrepreneurial business, and actually people can work in their homes, which keeps the reduces the impact on the climate. And of course, we want to grow those rural towns because people do want a place to recreate. You know, I love Morrisville, my town. We have two pubs that serve food and have musical entertainment. I live up on the Green River Reservoir, 12 miles out of town, but I go into town to recreate. You know, I don't drive to Burlington because I've got this wholesome community that I have. So that's kind of where I see growing Vermont, which will help us reduce our carbon footprint. And let me also point out, and I also, you know, this, when we get to the climate change issue, you know, I participated on the development of the Solar Pathways Plan, and having a reliable and solid connection with fiber is actually critical to solving climate change because we want to be able to communicate with our appliances and send price signals.
Let's go to Trevor, who's calling in from Killington. Hi, Trevor. You're on the air.
Hi there. My question for Christine Hallenquist is, what are you going to do to address the issue of young people leaving the state? I asked Bill Scott this question a couple months ago when he was on this program, and he said affordable housing. Do you agree with his answer?
So, Trevor, your line was a little fuzzy, but just to clarify for people who might have also been driving and not able to hear, you're asking about affordability, young people leaving the state, and Governor Phil Scott said affordable housing is key, and you're asking Christine Hallquist, does she agree, or what's her plan?
Well, I should start, Trevor, by saying that no young person is going to stay in Vermont if they can't get connected. So we absolutely have to get the fiber connections to attract young people and entrepreneurs. Vermont's a pretty awesome state from a, you know, outdoor recreation standpoint. We're the safest state. We're the healthiest state. We have the highest education performance. Awesome, awesome outdoors and awesome people. So we've got a lot that can attract young people. But nobody – in fact, I have a hard time. I can't work in rural Vermont because of my connection. So let's start with that as the baseline. But let's talk about affordable housing because I want young people to understand what's happened with affordability. If we had adjusted the minimum wage for inflation since the late 60s right now, it'd be $22 an hour. And pretty much people got benefits then. So $22 an hour works out to $44,000 a year. Throw in $10,000 of benefits. The average – minimum wage was over $50,000. So the most important thing we can do is narrow that wealth gap that started with Ronald Reagan in the early 80s, the attack on the labor unions and the air traffic controllers. We got to narrow the wealth gap, which is why I supported an increase in the minimum wage. I should also point out, remember that number, $22 an hour? When you talk to any developer or you talk to housing partnerships, I ask them, what does it cost for a two-bedroom unit in Vermont today? They said you need to make $22 an hour. So the reality is, unless we have to do an incredible increase in the amount of investments we make for affordable housing. You know, Phil talks about the fact that, you know, he made a $35 million investment to spun $65 million in bonds. Well, we need about five times that in order to address this issue. So, you know, once again, you know, I look at what. You know, these feel-good policies, they don't really get to really solving the long-term issues. We got these short-term answers. So I am totally committed to get to the point where we have enough bond investment to satisfy the need for to fill the need for the affordable housing.
Are there any environmental regulations that you would relax in order to spur more construction of affordable housing?
I would certainly think I've heard a lot of people complain, a lot of builders complain. I'm not sure what the truth is in this. And I do think, yes, anything we can do to reduce the regulations, to reduce the cost and speed up the construction of housing is important.
But now, you don't have specifics on that.
No, I don't have specifics because I get mixed. I have real estate agents that tell me, look, you know, I will tell you my personal experience with the utility. We had to face regulations even tighter than Act 250. They weren't a problem for us. You know, we knew what we had to do. We complied with it, and we got things permitted. We never really had a problem. So I hear mixed reviews from real estate agents. Some real estate agents tell me, no, our policies are fine. We like it the way it is because of the way Vermont is. But I have others that say, oh, no, this is a big impediment. So, I don't know what the truth is in this, but certainly, you know, it deserves a deep dive, but it's not going to solve the problem. The real problem is it costs $22 an hour to live in a two-bedroom unit, and our minimum wage is at $10.50.
So for you, it's less about building new affordable housing and more making sure that people can afford the housing that we have.
That's right. I think the problem will solve itself if people can afford to pay for the housing. The issue today is you can't. It costs $250,000 to build a two-bedroom unit. You got to make $22 an hour. You know, you've got to change the equation somehow.
And let's go to Matthew, who's calling in from Windsor. Hi, Matthew. You're on the air.
Hey, this is a question for Christine. Hey, I noticed you talked about root cause analysis at one of your debates. My question is, next time you talk about gun control, have you run through the root cause analysis of what the problems really are?
Well, that is an excellent question. I'm not sure that we've done a root cause analysis of what the violence issues are, and I think that's really getting back to what you got to do for long term solutions. I do support the legislation that was passed, and I commend the governor for signing it. But I will tell you my experience when it comes to health and safety is we need to focus heavily on building emotional emotional safety in the schools. If you look at the Fairhaven incident, that was prevented because some students spoke out. And I think we should work real hard, and I will work real hard to create emotional safety in schools, drive out fear so that students can talk about these issues, as well as address the the root cause of bullying and hatred, I do think we've focusing on physical security is important. I do think common sense gun laws are important. I think the next thing we need to work on is building emotional safety in our schools and our communities. If you look at this incident that just happened over the weekend with the threat on the Republican, I want to remind people we prevented the incident in Fairhaven because people spoke up. When you see someone who goes out and does a death threat, it's up to all of us. Somebody else must know about that. And I would encourage them to call the authorities and share the information, because we can never take anything like that lightly.
Matthew, I sensed some position underlying your question. So did you get what you were hoping for from Christine Hellquist?
No, not really. I mean, I don't think anybody's done the analysis on this. I have. And, the problem statement would be people killing people in public spaces, because that's happening all over. Now, where I got to was economic suppression of the middle class. I believe that this is a problem that we're seeing. I had crazy people in the 80s in school, but they never crossed the line to do this. And you ask yourself, why? Well, because they had things to lose. Today, with the suppression of the middle class, I don't think people have as much to lose.
So, Matthew, let me ask you then. I'm going to push you really, really quickly here before we come back to other callers and to Christine Hellquist. So we were talking earlier about broadband development, making sure that everybody in all communities have access to high-speed internet. She was talking about lifting the minimum wage to $15 an hour. So are those things that you see as policies that would help what you see as suppression of the middle class?
It's an underlying root cause of big business today is they're making record profits, and we're seeing a 2 or 3% increase in our wages. Now, I don't work for a small company. I work for a major pharmaceutical company. So I'm seeing it here. I'm sure everybody down from me in the work environment is seeing it too.
Yeah, Matthew, I take your point, and it's interesting because, that question of root causes of violence, root causes have been addressed by gun control is one question, and it's obviously, as with any issue, so much broader than just one specific issue. But Matthew brought up guns, and we've talked a little bit about what you see as an imperative to make sure that schools are safe places. But Christine Hellquist, you said you support the gun restrictions that were put in place by the legislature and signed by Governor Scott earlier this year. Are there other things that you would like to see specifically in terms of gun control?
Well, let me just also add, the legislation was good, but we need to put in the protocols in place to support that legislation. I think it's going to be about 2 years of work there. When it comes to removing weapons from people who might be a threat to themselves or others, I know I've talked to law enforcement officials. They need the protocols. How are we going to do this? They don't want to make the wrong decisions. So setting those procedures and protocols will be important. And when it comes to actually gun databases, we want to make sure that those are available to everyone, those gun databases.
What gun database?
And talking about doing background checks and providing, what you see with these gun issues is a lot of times these mass shootings, people were aware there was a danger, but the database was not available. So we have work to do there.
You mean the database of people who should not be allowed to have guns because of mental health or other reasons?
Right.
Not background checks on everybody who owns a gun.
Yes, we do need to do background checks.
We do background checks, but there's no database of gun owners.
There is a database, but it's too slow to access.
There is not a database of gun owners.
No, there's not a database of gun owners. No, I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying we're starting from the legislation that was passed.
I see. So the database that is already existent of people who should not be allowed to guns, that should be faster.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're not advocating for a federal registry of guns.
No, I'm not advocating for a federal registry.
But you would like to see more enforcement and greater investment in the gun laws that have been put in place.
Yes.
On mental health, which we were talking about a little bit, we got a note from a psychologist, Dr. Judith Markey, who owns the St. Johnsbury Psychology Associates Practice, who says, says, community mental health centers in Vermont are overwhelmed. Many have long waiting lists for individuals seeking mental health care. Because of this, licensed psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, and mental health counselors in independent practice provide the bulk of mental health and psychotherapy care in Vermont. Many independent practitioners, however, cannot sustain their practices because clinician rates of reimbursement from Medicaid and Medicare, as well as commercial insurances, have declined significantly over the past 25 years. What are your thoughts about the state of mental health care in Vermont, particularly regarding how Vermonters can gain access to quality mental health care when they need it?
Yeah, we have a lot of work to do in the area of mental health. I was actually down at the Brattleboro retreat last week, and you know, I'm happy that they're adding 16 beds. When I talked to and I also was in the Northwest Correctional Facility the week before that. You know, we have people in prison because we have no place to put them because they have mental health issues. It's kind of the worst thing you can do is leave people in prison, and then you'd go to the hospitals, the ER rooms. The nurses are so understaffed that when someone comes with a mental health issue, they get stuck in a room somewhere. They don't get the support. So I will tell you, there's in every case, it's much better to invest on the proactive side than the reactive side. And increasing mental health support is critical in order to reduce our incarceration rates over the long term. That's the most expensive way to deal with things. So I definitely support more investment in mental health because it's you get a greater return on your dollar. And I personally, you know, I know the value I transitioned. But I spent 5 years with a counselor, a transgender counselor, to help with that transition. I would not be sitting here today if it were not for that. So I'm a strong believer in mental health support. I think offering mental health wraparound services in schools is important. I've even had fellow CEOs that I've told them, look, you're holding your business back because of some of your personal issues. Go get some mental health support and you're going to grow your business.
So when you look at specifics, though, you've mentioned a couple different things, and some of it is outpatient support, access to counselors and psychologists and psychiatrists. But some of it, you also talk about a lack of bed space in critical care units. And, you know, we saw after Tropical Storm Irene, when the state hospital was closed, that the new model that was put in place and advocated for by Governor Shumlin was one with fewer acute care beds in a central location and more trying to get people back to their communities for outpatient care, especially faster. And we've seen this backlog in emergency care facilities where people can't find a bed that specifically addresses mental health care. So are you advocating for more acute care beds, another hospital? I mean, what does the model look like of actually making sure that people have the care that they need?
Well, one of the limitations is Medicare. You know, Medicare isn't going to reimburse for anything over 16 beds, which I think is a bit of a problem because I think the Brattleboro retreat knows how to handle these issues. You know, I know there's been issues with them in the past, but overall, you know, we need those beds. But I also will tell you, you know, the pendulum might have swung too far because when I talk to mental health professionals, they think, you know, the group home concept worked very well because it gave mental health professionals the chance to get respite and training. You know, when you get down to individual homes and those kind of things, it puts too much stress on the caretakers. So, you know, there's that I think we can provide more group home settings, and the group home settings would be very effective. And I'm also believing in the housing first model, meaning, you know, we have housing that says you can't be a substance user, you can't be a substance abuser, you can't be a, you know, alcohol abuse to be in the place. Let's get them in the homes so that they can get support because they're not getting support out on the streets.
Let's go to George, who's calling in from Warren. Hi, George. What's your question?
Yes, good morning. You seem to like to use anecdotes about local and being from Morrisville. An old guy told me once, he says, it's not what you make, it's what you keep. And stemming into that, I believe that the affordability issue is clearly based on the fact that education in Act 60 is virtually gutting Vermont. I travel all around the state and see how things have died out. Our education taxes is nearly 5/6 of my property tax that's going to education. And while people are leaving the schools are becoming smaller, that literally that's not sustainable. It's only getting worse, and in that hence, you know, property tax on second homes that was passed in the legislature is certainly going to put the burden on apartments and affordable housing and the kind of things that people can't invest in. So somehow, somewhere, that has to be solved, and it's one of the things that works backwards to everything everybody's been saying is the affordability. But education right now, the way we're funding it and how it operates is unsustainable, and that makes Vermont die by a thousand cuts.
That's well, George, you've teed it up for Christine Hallquist here, who has some ideas for ways to change our education funding model in Vermont, and you've been rolling some of them out, although I'd love to hear more specifics.
Sure. There's a lot there. And first of all, let me start with the premise that, you know, that essentially we're going down the tubes. Let me start by saying, I've worked with rural America, and there's a direct relationship between cost and density. And Vermont is the most rural state in the union, so theoretically we should be the most expensive. We're the fifth most expensive, which means we're doing a pretty good job. Now, that isn't a cop out, because I do think we have a lot we can do. And I don't think we should be paying for our schools with the property tax. The property tax has a long history to it of imbalance. Just as and I was actually on the Hyde Park School Board when we filed the suit that resulted in Act 60. But yet, you know, here in New Hampshire and Vermont, I was just reading an article about New Hampshire. Same problems we're having today. We haven't yet fixed the problem. And if you look at the 2019 education budget, I'm gonna give you some data. You know, if when it comes to your percentage of income that you're paying for the education tax, if you're making less than $150,000, it ranges from 2.3 to 2.5%. But over $150,000, it quickly goes down to the point where a person making $1 million only pays 0.5%. So, you know, I'm all about reforming how we pay for schools, going to a more income-based formulas. And of course, with our aging demographic, that's really important, because you know, we want people to be able to stay in their homes when they get on fixed income, and that helps address that as well. So I would advocate more to an income-based formula. I will tell you that my plan is that we're going to grow Vermont, and we're going to put kids back in those schools. So we're going to need those schools. But I'm also going to point out the difference between Phil Scott's leadership and my leadership. You know, Phil Scott believes in command and control. And I think command and control is great during fire and power outages, but the rest of the time you should be focused on collaboration. I have a long history of leadership. It's not just at the co-op. And I have a long history of working with many companies. And I know that the best ideas come from the employees. So Phil, you know, he barks orders from Montpelier. He comes up with arbitrary metrics and then beats up the school boards and the teachers. That's not how you get the best answers. You work with boots on the ground with those school boards and those teachers, and we will come up with better solutions. And some of those solutions include providing wraparound services in these schools that are paid for out of separate parts of our Vermont budget. So providing mental health care, pediatric care, and daycare services in the schools is a way to better optimize those. So that's the difference. I'm going to work collaboratively, and we're going to come up with better solutions.
Before the break, we were talking a little bit about education, and I just want to dial back on that or come back to it so that we can talk a little bit more about some of the specifics of what you talk about with collaboration. I want to ask your thoughts on Act 46, and this is the district merger plan, which actually included a lot of opportunities for collaboration and for voluntary district mergers before any kind of mandatory merger process kicked in. And we are at the mandatory stage now, and it's causing some major problems for some Vermont communities and some educational communities. But when you talk about a look at Vermont's schools and the cost and how rural schools do cost a lot of money and the need for a collaborative approach, is there a need for the state ever to say, look, if we're going to solve this problem with how much it costs, the state is going to have to impose some specifics on towns and schools that may not want them for the benefit of the greater good?
Well, let me just say, first of all, closing rural schools goes totally against my goal of growing our rural economy.
And Act 46, to be clear, does not specify closing schools.
Yeah. But let me just I agree with that. But let me just say, I don't think we should close rural schools, because if you close a rural school, you now people are not going to come to that community. So we just exacerbate our existing demographic problem. And I was going to add exactly, I think Act 46 has ways for people to deal with that. So Act 46 has been pretty effective. If you look at the 2019 education budget, two-thirds of the schools have merged, the schools districts. There's actually been 44 alternative plans that have been submitted, and Phil Scott's Education Department rejected 39 of those 44, accepted 5. Those plans, there are alternative plans built into the – you are allowed to submit alternative plans. And I think that that is a collaborative approach. You know, I do think that Act 46, it's taken a lot of hits. But it's not about how you – it's not Act 46. It's how you carry it out. And certainly as a governor, I would be very flexible in working with those schools and communities and trying to achieve their goals. Because I – again, there's another thing I believe through my experience with leadership is 95% of people get up every day and want to do a good job, and people are committed to these goals. And I will tell you, you know, if you look what happened this year, the governor had set a target of 2.5% for the total increase in school budgets across the state. They came at it 1.5%. I would have celebrated that and said, let's go to the next goal. Not undermine it and pull the rug out and change it at the last minute.
We could, as we've done in the past, do an entire hour on school funding, and I'm sure we'll do more of those again. But I want to get to some of the other issues that are important for a governor to be considering. James in Leicester says, Vermont's under a federal mandate to clean up Lake Champlain, and Vermont conventional dairy contributes nearly half the pollutants. These two are inextricably connected, and yet Vermont has no workable solution to help either. We are tired of platitudes. What's your policy?
Well, I actually think there's a well-written plan. Beth Pierce, the state treasurer, has put together the funding plan for how we do that. And I support that plan, and we will figure out how to fund it because every dollar that we spend on cleanup of our waterways saves $3 in the long term. And it's $25 million a year, and we need to fund that over the long term. And I want to point out that 94% of our waterways are impacted by runoff. And certainly dairy is a major issue, but I don't want to beat up the dairy farmers because they're committed as well to solving the problem. But we've learned, as we learn and change rules, you know, it puts an impact on our dairy farmers who are already struggling. And I think what we need to do is follow our forestry model. You know, if you look at the current use model, people are happy with the forestry model. You have a forester that works with the landowner. I think we can treat farms the same way. I think we should have somebody who works with a farm on the soil who helps achieve this. We don't have that today to work the overall cycle, and to share the best practices. But at the same time, I think we dairy's struggling. We're seeing 30% more milk produced today than the 1960s. The market is flooded. That's where I think fiber to the home and business will help. You know, if you look, we have a wonderful maple industry that's very successful. Took us decades to build up the distribution network. We're selling the Japanese.
But wait, let me bring you back to James's question, because specifically he's asking about the connection between conventional dairy and pollution and water cleanup. So you know, what would you do? And James says, I don't want platitudes. I want specifics.
No, I'm getting there.
Sorry, we've got 6 minutes, so I'm going to push you to those faster.
Okay. So the point is, we want to give people an opportunity for another revenue stream. So using the model like the Hardwick Food Hub, cooperative packaging and processing facilities, using the internet, you know, we can start growing other products and selling finished goods all across the world. That gives the farmers an alternative revenue stream and helps keeping our existing farms and helps keep. Sorry about.
So how does that though? So are you saying we would reduce the need for large conventional dairy and move to a different model? I mean, do you envision in theory a Vermont with less of a reliance on conventional dairy?
Yeah, I think it has to get there because we have to provide other revenue streams for the farmers. We don't want to lose the farms, but dairy is an oversaturated market.
So you would sort of remove some of the protection for dairy farmers or try to move them in a different direction because it's unsustainable, do you think, to have the same dairy model we currently have?
It's clearly unsustainable because the dairy farms are closing and suffering, and it's moved to this large dairy model. But I know we want to keep the Vermont the way it is.
What about healthcare? You'd like to see regional collaboration on a universal healthcare plan where we move towards universal healthcare as a region rather than as a state. Vermont failed to be able to find a way to do that under the Shumlin administration. What would your model look like?
Well, you know, I this is where I appeal to the viewers. Holy cow, do not accept anything but Medicare for all, because making money off people's death and dying is not acceptable. I'll make it short and quick to get to keep things going. But you know, we need to continue to move towards Medicare for all. Vermont went down that path. We're a small state, 0.2% of the national population. But there are other big states that want to do this, including California. I would form a pool with those states in order to get to Medicare for all, as well as use that pool to push back on some of these hostile things coming out of Washington. And I would also work with the legislature to immediately adopt a universal primary care model, because that does pay for itself. I can get down and dirty with numbers with anybody and show how that pays for itself.
So marijuana, support legalization? Do you want to see a commercial tax and regulate structure?
Yes. In marijuana, we're in the most dangerous place right now. I'm going to argue it from a safety standpoint. People don't know where their pot's coming from.
This would be your first term in office, period. So how would Vermont look different 2 years into a Christine Hallquist administration than it does now?
Well, you're going to see the most accessible administration you've ever seen. You know, when I became CEO of the co-op, I took the lock off my door and we put a conference table in because I knew I wouldn't be in that office. Good leadership is out there, boots on the ground.
So good leadership, but if I'm thinking about my life right now, if I'm a voter and I'm thinking about broadband, I'm thinking about education funding, I'm thinking about how much stress I feel, or maybe I'm not, you know, maybe I have different considerations. What's going to actually look different?
Oh, you're going to see family leave. You're going to see the minimum wage rising. You're going to see the beginnings of the rollout of the fiber optic every business. You know, at the end of 2 years, we will achieve those goals for sure.
What's the one issue that hasn't come up today that you think is important for voters to know where you stand on?
Well, I will tell you that, you know, I'm going to point out my leadership style. When I took over the co-op was on the edge of bankruptcy. The state was ready to put it out of business, had the highest rates in the state, the highest number of outages. I pulled the employees together and I said, look, I've got a lot of business experience, but I only give myself a 10% chance. And I also told them from that point on, we all abide by the union contract. And 5 years later, the Department of Energy recognized us as the most innovative utility in the country. We cut our outages over half. We became an A-plus rated utility by the rating agencies. Most financial people would tell you that's impossible. But I know when people pull together, we can do incredibly great things. And that's really what I'm about, is pulling people together to do great things and pulling shoulder to shoulder as equals.
And is 2 years enough time for you to do that? I mean, you only get a 2-year term as governor.
Well, you know, this is really up to the voters. The voters should demand leadership that takes people in that direction. It's that, you know, if you're not moving to Medicare for all and solving these problems, fire the leader and hire another one. It's not about me. It's about the direction we need to take.
That's Christine Hallquist, Democratic candidate for governor. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
You can listen back to our interview with Republican challenger Phil Scott, as well as our interviews with independent candidates, by looking at the Campaign 2018 page at vpr.net. And join us on October 24th for our live gubernatorial debate at 7 p.m.